Sally Mauch has done literally thousands of interviews in her 34 years with Montana Public Radio, so to pick a handful of best of is impossible, but we'd like to play a few that Sally and we think our listeners, deem among the most memorable. Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal, politicians know they have to be on their game when sitting in front of the microphone with Sally. In 2008, Hillary Clinton was campaigning for president in Missoula. After her speech in an airplane hangar near the Missoula airport, Clinton and Sally sat down backstage for a one-on-one interview.
I just have a few quick questions that
Absolutely.
I think are on the minds of Montanans that I'd like to talk about. First has to do with coal. I've read your energy plan, and I know coal is part of that, clean coal, and that you also have a plan to develop carbon sequestration and coal to liquids. But those are technologies that are still a ways away. In the meantime, would you support a moratorium on new coal-fired power plants?
Well, let me say three things about this. Number one, I don't see how we become energy independent if we don't figure out how to use our coal reserves in a way that is as clean and as green as possible. That means we've got to start doing the research and the demonstration projects right now. I have been advocating 10 big demonstration projects in different parts of the country, like here in Montana. We've got to figure out whether different forms of coal have different kinds of properties that will make it more challenging or less so. So let's begin the research. The Bush administration won't even do that. They just canceled the NextGen project that was scheduled to go forward in Illinois. It's also important, though, to emphasize energy efficiency and to work with our utilities for them to realize that they need to be partners in conservation and efficiency measures where the consumer will realize the benefits along with the utility instead of just keeping pushing higher and higher demand. I was just in Portland yesterday. Portland is now 1% below their 1990 greenhouse gas emissions. It's doable, but we're just not doing it. So, yes, I would like to see us hold off on new coal power plant construction while we push to do the demonstration projects, push to do the energy efficiency. In some places that's practical, in other places it isn't. But the longer we wait, the less likely we're going to be able to have the right solutions.
You spoke today in Missoula in front of an air tanker, and in a couple of months, Montana will have its fire season, and our fire seasons are getting much worse. We have smoky summers now, and in part that's because, the Forest Service says, because their budgets have been cut, and the current proposal from the current administration is to cut it again, and so they can't do the kind of forest management they'd like. What would be your forest policy?
Well, can I just say that this is another example of the Bush administration putting ideology and other priorities above sensible forest management. The money should be there because look at what happens. It's a typical example. We don't spend the money to thin the forest, to manage it appropriately. Then we spend the money to try to deal with the consequences of that. The Bush administration in several states has been resistant to implementing what is agreed upon between both environmentalists and local communities, as well as timber companies, to at least get people working to thin out a lot of the forests. They'd rather hold their ground ideologically until they can go back to clear cutting. You know, this is the kind of mindset we're dealing with in Washington. So let's get to sensible forest management policies with adequate resources to actually implement them. And I will certainly do that once we see the end of President Bush's administration.
Both you and Senator Obama make Native American issues a priority in your campaign speeches, and many administrations have made the same promises, of course, and still Native Americans have a lower life expectancy than the rest of the population, still have rampant poverty on many reservations, some of them in Montana. What would your administration do to make those promises real?
I'm well aware of all the broken promises going back hundreds of years, and there's a lot of work to be done. I know that we're facing a backlog of unmet needs and missed opportunities. But I've had a long record of caring about and focusing on issues in Indian country, and lots in Indian country know that. My husband convened a National Tribal Council meeting in the White House, and we were making progress trying to, you know, untangle the bureaucracy and increase the funding for everything from the Indian Health Services to law enforcement. I want to make this a priority. I worked hard with a coalition of senators to increase the amount of money we'd put into the Indian Health Services. Now we've got to make sure the money actually gets delivered, something that is not a priority of the Bush administration. But I also want us to understand how we can be a better partner in our government relations with our respect for tribal sovereignty. For example, if I am successful in getting to universal health care, that will help so many Native Americans. Then the Indian Health Service becomes a safety net program, a delivery system instead of a primarily funding system. We've got to look at how we're going to empower our tribes. We've made some progress on that, but not nearly enough. So there's an incredible agenda to empower our tribes to take advantage of their natural resources, to be partners in so much of what we wish to do. You know, a lot of the land here in Montana, North Dakota, and elsewhere that would be prime land for wind farms is on reservations. We got to get transmission lines so that we can basically turn, you know, tribal wind farms into mini utilities. I mean, there's so much I want to do, and I'm excited about doing it. And I'm going to have a Native American representative inside the White House. I'm going to appoint Native Americans to many positions across the board. I'm going to make the Indian Health Services an assistant secretary position. We're going to really put actions behind our words and implement these policies.
One last question, and it's a horse race question. A lot of young people I ask who they are supporting and why, and not one says that race or gender is a factor, which is progress, actually. But they do say change is what they most are concerned about, and not just change in policy, but change in how government is governed. And that's where your opponent seems to be getting the upper hand with younger people. What do you say to them to convince them that Senator Clinton, as President Clinton, would bring real change to how government operates?
Well, I would ask them, number one, to look at what I've done. I have been a fighter for change in our government for many years, on the outside and on the inside. And I've produced results for people. Maybe some of these young people over the last 11 years took advantage of the Children's Health Insurance Program, which I helped to create. You know, maybe some of them are either thinking about or members of the National Guard and Reserve. And I joined across the aisle with Republicans to create a health care program that every National Guard and Reserve member would be entitled to along with their families. You know, a lot of what we talk about is abstract unless you bring it down to earth. What does change mean? It's not just a feeling. It has to be rooted in how to actually deliver results, solutions for our problems. That's what I'm offering. And I understand completely that, you know, being fresh and new on the national scene carries with it a certain excitement. And that is great because people are coming into this process and we're going to keep them in the Democratic Party. But I think it's also important to stop and ask, who has the track record? You know, if you were looking for a surgeon to operate on a loved one, you'd probably find somebody who had some experience. And that isn't that you would be turning your back on somebody who'd never done it before, but you might not want it done in something as important as your own family. Well, this, our country, is like our family. We've got to have a president who on day one can start turning it around. And it's not going to happen by hoping for it or wishing for it. It's going to happen because somebody with the experience and the strength and the willingness to fight for it is going to be in that White House. And that's what I'm offering. And we've seen in a number of the elections in Massachusetts, in California, in other places, I've won the youth vote. So I think it's really just getting out there and talking to young people. My husband, my daughter, and I going to campuses, making our case and letting people understand that it's not being for or against either of us. This is a great choice. You can be for both of us, but at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, who would you hire for the toughest job in the world? And I think I can make a pretty good case for myself.
Senator Clinton, thank you very much, and welcome back to Montana.
It is so great being here. Thank you so much.
In 2006, incumbent Republican Senator Conrad Burns was in a tight re-election fight with Democratic challenger John Tester. In a lengthy interview, excerpted here, Burns had some surprising answers to Sally's questions about U.S. foreign policy.
But no administration has been hit with the catastrophes that this administration has been hit with. 9-1-1, Katrina, Iraq, the war on terror, and the war on this country.
Well, the war in Iraq was not a catastrophe that hit the country. That was a decision, policy decision that was made.
Policy was made on September the 11th, 2001.
You're saying Iraq had something to do with September 11th?
There's no question in my mind.
That Iraq had something to do with September 11th?
Well, sure. It was the stem of terrorism. That's where were they getting their money?
Foreign intelligence has shown no connection between Iraq and September 11th, Senator.
Isn't that funny? That's the spin on it.
You don't believe that?
I do. Well, I have every reason not to believe it.
And what is your reason?
Well, the reason I know. I just know. I just know. I mean, here's a guy that supported the families and recruited their kids to blow other people up. Does not that count? Does it not count that he did have weapons of mass destruction used on his own people and the Kurds? Does that not count? We know that they were there, don't we? We know they were there.
Inspectors say they weren't when we went
in. Do we know that they were there? Is there any reason to believe until he really felt threatened or under inspection that he would not move them?
What do you think of the National Security Agency monitoring Americans' phone calls?
They've not monitoring any phone calls of private citizens, not mine or yours.
Those made overseas.
And I think whenever you have an incident that happened and you have to looking for intelligence on what we should do and how we should go about it, it makes perfectly good sense to me. He never broke the law. And
well, there's some dispute about whether he should have gone to FISA, Foreign Intelligence.
But actually, you know, maybe time was of the essence. Who knows what's next Monday or next Tuesday?
It's okay with you if the government listens in on your phone calls?
Well, I got nothing to hide. But I don't think I'd like for my citizens. I don't think that's right at all. And that's not what's happening. What is happening is international calls or those numbers who are attracted to terrorism or terrorism cells.
Time magazine came out with an article where they listed what they felt were the 10 best senators and the 5 worst senators in the country. They put you in the latter category. One of the primary reasons was your, quote, meager record in the Senate, meaning the lack of what their view of meaningful legislation being sponsored by you.
Well, any time that I'm in the bottom 10 and Kennedy's in the top 10, that's pretty good company.
Burns went on to lose the 2006 election to Senator John Tester. In 2002, the late part-time Montana resident, former senator from South Dakota, and 1972 Democratic presidential nominee George McGovern joined Sally for a wide-ranging interview about the hunger issue he was working on at the time, and of course about politics. Here's an excerpt.
You mentioned earlier that fewer and fewer people are voting in every election, and I know that when you ran in 1972, you talked a lot about how the process of electing president in this country needed to be reformed, and mm-hmm. campaign finance reform was something long overdue. Not much has changed. If anything, it's gotten worse in terms
yes.
of the influence of money on politics.
The influence of money on politics is quite a bit worse than it was 30 years ago when I was seeking the presidency. We ran that whole campaign. We won 11 primaries, paid for the national convention since the Democratic National Committee was broke, and then paid for the general election. We did the whole thing on about $32 million. Now we spend that
that's
much.
That's a Senate campaign in New York,
campaign,
I think.
And California, even in South Dakota this last time. The two candidates for the Senate combined spent $25 million. So we haven't made much progress in dealing with the money question in politics, but I think that's still an enormous question, a very important one. One thing we did do in 72, we opened up the presidential nominating process to women, to minorities, to young people. For the first time in 72, all of those groups were participating in roughly the same percentage as they bore to the population as a whole.
Many of us feel right now, Senator McGovern, that these are especially perilous times in the world. And I know you do a lot of traveling, not just around the U.S., but mm-hmm. around the world. What's your sense of the general, I don't know if it's political or social or cultural climate that you find out there in terms of, are you, as someone who has been so involved in the mm-hmm. top issues of the day, feeling that these are perilous times as well or times of great opportunity?
I think both of those things are true. First of all, times are not as perilous today as they were during most of the years since World War II, when you had this enormous, wide-open nuclear race between the Soviet Union and the United States. One false move either on the part of Moscow or Washington, and you and I probably wouldn't be sitting here today. This planet would be a smoking chasm because the two sides compiled enough nuclear power to pulverize everything that lives on the planet several times over. Now, that's pretty well gone, that danger. Not that Russia and the United States don't still have large nuclear stockpiles, but they've pretty well stabilized the relationship between the two countries. We now trade with each other. We have open diplomacy, and I think the danger of a nuclear conflagration has been greatly reduced, although it's still there, and we still have to be careful about it. What I see, though, out across the world that's perilous is the growth of extremist elements in many countries that are angry, that are furious, that are ready to die for their cause. I see the combination of extreme religious views with political power. That's what this terrorism business is all about. I don't see terrorists posing anything like the threat that the two great nuclear powers pose to each other, but I do see them with the capacity to disrupt life in our country and in other countries. And that's why I would like to see us, while being on guard with our CIA and our FBI and our police forces and so on against terrorists, I would like to see us giving more time and attention to the root causes of terrorism. And I think many people around the world see that as an important priority. And it's one of the reasons I think if we can get through this current crisis, we may be on the verge of a much more secure and prosperous world community in the years ahead. I'm an optimist. I don't believe the world is about to collapse. I think we're moving into what may be the best 25 or 50 years the world has ever known. We've made great gains in science, in healthcare, in protecting the environment, in developing a more cooperative economic system around the world. I think those are all positive things.
And the world is indeed getting smaller, and that's a good thing.
It is. We're becoming one world, in fact, as well as in theory.
Senator McGovern, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come and talk to us about some of these issues, all of which you are well-versed in, and certainly it's been a pleasure to speak with you, and I want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
Well, the same to you.
Of course, politics hasn't been Sally's only beat. Name the issue, and Sally surely has interviewed someone, in fact, several people about it, no matter how controversial, especially if it's controversial. That includes the volatile issue of gun control. Last year, several Montana sheriffs stated they would not enforce any laws that seek to confiscate guns. Lake County Sheriff Jay Doyle went so far as to issue a press release to that effect. Here's an excerpt of Sally's interview with Sheriff Doyle.
I think that especially in Montana and the area that I'm from, the folks are very concerned about their gun rights, as am I, and whether or not they're reading something into what's going on over in Washington, D.C. Or not, I don't know. I had been asked by several people via email and phone what my stance on gun control was, and if I would uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the state of Montana. So I came out with my press release and stated that I would uphold those, and I think that law-abiding citizens do have the right to own and possess guns.
I think President Obama and Congress would agree with you there. They've said publicly that they agree with the Second Amendment. You just don't believe them, or?
what I am saying is if they made an attempt to come in and seize weapons from somebody from Lake County, they would not be getting any assistance from my office. And in fact, if I found that out, I'd be at whatever residence that they're at trying to put a stop to it.
Physically try to stop them, you're saying you would do?
Absolutely. If they're breaking the Second Amendment, then that's not right either.
Do you agree with some, Sheriff Doyle, that local sheriffs, it's completely up to them to decide what's constitutional and what isn't, that each individual sheriff gets to make that decision?
I think that the Constitution speaks for itself. I think it's up to each sheriff to read and understand the Constitution, and if it comes into question, then he or she should either get advice or interpreted how he or she deems necessary.
Because, as you know, there are many sheriffs who support tighter gun control around the country and some who don't, obviously. And what I'm asking is, do you think that that is a feasible way to govern, to have each individual sheriff make up their mind about what's constitutional and what isn't, that there isn't some sort of universal agreement about that?
I think that the gun laws that we have already, they should be enforced if they're not already enforced. What I'm trying to say is that if something new comes down the pike, that weapons or firearms are trying to be confiscated or seized, I would not agree with that.
Sheriff, what do you think of more background checks than what we have now?
I think what we've got right now is sufficient.
So you think it's okay if some mentally ill people can go to a gun show and purchase a gun?
I don't think that a mentally ill person, if they are a hazard to themselves or others, I don't think that that they should be able to have a firearm until they are deemed fit.
How would we know if there was no background check?
That's a good question.
Are you getting a lot of feedback from people about all this?
I'm getting lots of feedback, lots of positive feedback from residents in my county. They're glad that I have the stance that I do. They feel that it is in their right to own and possess firearms, and I agree with it.
Well, I have been speaking with Lake County Sheriff Jay Doyle, and Sheriff Doyle, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Every summer, Sally has donned her Nomex and joined firefighters on the fire line, taking us into the raging fires in the Bitterroot in 2000 through to last summer's Lolo Creek complex. Soon after, several Sleeman Gulch residents were evacuated and then allowed to return to their still-standing homes. Sally sat down with them to talk about what it's like to be evacuated from a fire and to leave behind a home you don't know if you will ever see again. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
But I think what really brought it home to us was when we got the sheriff was at the door, and this is exactly what he said is, I'm not going to sugarcoat this, folks. If nothing changes, the fire's going to come through the gulch tonight. And so that was the moment when I really realized we could lose our home tonight.
What kind of a night did you have that night?
Oh, you know, I've only been in the house 2 months, so I was really kind of cussing out the previous owner because I know he knew this was coming.
After you cussed him out, it had to be a pretty nerve-wracking night.
Yeah, but, you know, as I've told anybody that would listen, you know, I've been around for a while. I've been over 60 and plus, and I've had bad things happen to me in my life, and it seems like every time something bad has happened, something better has come along to counteract that afterwards, and it's, you don't let events shape your reaction, you react to them, you know. It's, you can make it a tragedy or you can make it a blessing. It's all in how you, I don't know, digest it. So mm-hmm. So that's what I was doing. I was preparing myself for coming back and finding a basement and a pile of ashes. And so I was ready for that.
Mark and Sally, what do you think the blessing has been that Ken is talking about? One of the blessings, it seems to me, is you all are sitting here and you seem very close right now.
I think we are very close, and the fire helped bring us even closer together. I think we all have to make this decision. What do we take out? I remember in 2000 when we evacuated, I think I took Grandma's recipe book and just about everything else I could get my hands on. This time we left with about, I don't know, three or four pieces of art. And we said to ourselves that the real memories are in our hearts and our heads. They're not physical anymore, and that's, I think, the lesson that we learned. And the other thing that I'd share with people, if a fire is anywhere near you, it can move much, much faster than you can believe.
I remember when we first came back and after the evacuation was lifted, and that happened sooner than we thought, and walking around the property at home, and I just felt extremely humbled, I think, and appreciative in the way that Mark has talked about that what sticks and is important is people and your relationships with them and your memories of what's in your heart. And so much of that, I think, is I think for us will be a legacy of the strength of our working together, helping each other out, making good plans ahead of time to try to expedite that in our community here. And I'm just very appreciative that I have a home and people around me who care deeply for each other.
Maybe not such a bad week after all. Although we don't want to repeat it.
I got to hug almost everybody in the Gulch now. So that's pretty good.
I'll get in line for that. Well, I just want to say how grateful I am to all of you for sharing your stories, because I think it's really important at this time that we all learn from what has happened, and you are the teachers right now. So thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Over the years, Sally has done interviews with numerous writers, artists, and musicians. This 2009 interview with singer-songwriter Joan Baez struck more than a musical chord with our listeners.
Did you have stage fright early in your career then? Or
I had terrible stage fright at the beginning. I was so composed when I got out on the stage, but backstage it was a real hell. And then, you know, got over lots and lots of therapy, you know, but now there is none.
You have so many fans around the world who have been fans for a long time, and you're getting new fans all the time, too, I'm sure. It must be so rewarding to get out on the stage and have people who feel like they know you through your music.
It's very rewarding. They feel like friends. It's kind of goofy, you know, that I've been doing this for so long, and it's goofier that they're still coming to listen to it. You know, a little meditation before the show and a little thanks, because it really is a grace that I was born with this voice. I can't claim anything about it except, you know, maintenance and delivery and thanks.
Of course, interviewers have the prerogative of getting to talk about their favorite Joan Baez song, and so I get to talk about mine now and hope to get you to talk about it. And it's one of Dylan's songs that you recorded, Forever Young, which I liked even when I was young.
Oh, yeah, it's an extraordinary song.
Build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung, and may you stay.
I did sing it for a long time, and recently I've been singing it with many, many stories attached to it, like singing it when my parents got married for the second time. And it's a funny story, but the song is so meaningful that, you know, I can sing it in any context, and it's sobering and beautiful.
That's how I think of it, but feel free to tell the funny story.
You know, my father was 91, and he wrote a letter to my mom. They'd been divorced for 30 years, and wrote a letter to my mom and said, I want to die a married man, and you're the only person I want to be married to. And I asked my mom what she was going to do, and she said, oh, what the hell. They got married again.
And you sang that song at their second wedding.
I did.
The title song of your new album, Day After Tomorrow, is about a soldier in the Iraq War. Beautiful, beautiful song.
Yeah. Written by Tom Waits. And, you know, there are some songs I have to sort of study and see whether they'll work with me and for me. But this one I had to hear once, and it was very clear that it felt as though it were made for me. I had heard it once or twice, and it was in the repertoire immediately, and I put the words in front of me and sang it in concert as soon as I could.
At the end of the world, and I'll come home to Illinois on the day after tomorrow.
universal because it is about, I assume, about an Iraqi or Afghanistan vet, really. But when a song's that well written, then it's about any soldier anywhere.
The new album is produced by Steve Earle. He's been a collaborator of yours before, and it must be a joy to work together because the album is so beautiful. It has to be the product of a good collaboration.
Well, you're brilliant. Most people say, what was it like? But you got to the point right away. If it was a joy, he works the way I do. We did the album in less than 2 weeks, and it was simple. It was fun. He chose the musicians, and I chose all the songs except for his three. And, we just went in the studio, had biscuits, drank coffee, looked at the songs, and started to work. And they are so brilliant that they looked at the music, went over it a few times. Steve joined in, whatever instrument he wanted to play. And then I got into my little glass bubble and sang, and that was it.
You've always had an affinity for gospel, and one of the songs on the new album is a gospel-type song, Jericho Road.
Also a natural. It wasn't that easy, that one, because it's a cappella.
Well, Joshua fits the battle, that's how the story goes. The walls came a-tumbling down, I know, but I'm walking down the Jericho Road.
He was very cute. He said, people are going to be pissed off at me because I have three songs on here. I said, listen, you can have nine on here as far as I'm concerned. He's such a brilliant writer, mm-hmm. Song about Wanderer. He had a tune on one evening. He said, do you like the tune? And I said, oh, I love it. He said, well, maybe I'll write some words. And the next morning at 6 o'clock, he had the words. And so he's that kind of a writer. And so, I would, as many songs as he would want to write, I would be happy to record.
Your voice, as anyone's voice does, has changed over the years. And many of the reviews that I've read of your recent work, people are pleased with the changes in your voice. Are you pleased with the changes in your voice?
I don't have any choice about the changes. They are what come with getting older. They are what come with your vocal cords do what they do. I've chosen to work with the vocal cords, which means constant practice, and so it means coaching. And then I wouldn't be able to sing more than with a space of one octave if I didn't continue working and working very hard. And for the first 20 years of my career, I wouldn't have thought that because it all came so naturally. And sort of to my disillusionment and horror. In the middle of my 30s, I was, like everybody else, I had to deal with it. So the upper ranges are very, very difficult, but I prefer to keep them as much as I can. But no, the voice is much more congenial, and it's much, it shows 50 years, which in a way, I'm glad of it.
As are we. Well, I have been speaking with singer-songwriter Joan Baez, who will be giving a concert this week in Missoula and in Bozeman. Ms. Baez, thank you so much for all the great music and for the interview.
Thank you.
Build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung, and may you stay.
Some of Sally's interviews have been with other journalists, local, state, national, even international reporters. Her 2009 interview with ABC News and NPR political analyst Cokey Roberts was one of the most fun. They started out talking about a book Roberts wrote about influential women, but soon drifted into other topics. Here's the excerpt.
Your book starts with a little history of the second wave of pioneers like yourself who've broken down barriers for other women. And then you have this aside, and I just want to read from the book. And the aside is this. We've been known to grow a little grumpy over the ingratitude of young women for their sometimes smug assumption that all that woman stuff is passé, ancient history. We find ourselves muttering like the Wicked Witch of the West, just you wait, my pretty.
Or, just you wait, my pretty.
You do that much better than I do. And I'm from Kansas.
There you go. Well, there's part of me that feels very strongly that the reason that we fought as hard as we did and continue to fight as hard as we do was to make it so that women coming after us didn't have to think about it. And so I get that they are not sitting there spending all day every day saying, oh, aren't you wonderful that you fought these battles for us, and that they just take it for granted. And I think that's great. But there is another part of me that says they really don't understand that as they keep moving in both the world of work and the world of marriage, that they are likely to hit obstacles that will surprise them, and then they will figure out why it's important to keep vigilant.
It was so interesting to me during the 08 campaign that so many young women did not see Senator Clinton's bid for the presidency as particularly historic. I mean, they sort of took it for granted that she, of course, could serve as president if elected, and weren't necessarily behind her because of the historic nature of her candidacy, which is both progress and a problem, I think.
Yes, I think that's a very good way of putting it. Now, look, she was running against an incredibly charismatic candidate at a time when people were very eager to hear his message. But it is true that you did have a lot of older women my age and slightly younger than me, who were very excited about the concept of a woman president. But you did not see that trickling down into younger women, and that's just a further statement of what we were just talking about, that there is not that sense that this is all still a fight to be fought.
You write in your book about your dismay over how Senator Clinton and Governor Palin were treated in the election, and you write, quote, I want to quote from the book again, things that were said about the women running, the blatant sexism in the media and among the late-night comedians about New York Senator Hillary Clinton deeply depressed me, and the abuse of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, the Republican nominee for vice president, was particularly discouraging.
Well, I found that the questions posed to her about raising children just really did discourage me, because I thought maybe we were past that, but clearly not. And they came up just again recently with the naming of Kirsten Gillibrand as the senator from New York. Pat Schroeder went to Congress in 1972, and she was one of the first to go with little children, one of the first women to run for office as the mother of small children. And she thought, and I hoped, that she had put this question to rest with her very amusing answer to it, which was when people would ask her, well, who's going to take care of the children? A question that has never, ever, 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 ever been asked of a male politician. She would say, well, you know, the children are just fine. Jim and I get up in the morning and we feed them a nutritious breakfast, and then we put them in the freezer, and then we go off to work, and then we come home and we defrost them, and we give them a lovely dinner where we all converse amiably. And she was hoping that by ridiculing that question, that she would take it off the table. But clearly that has not happened in the last 37 years.
Some of my favorite parts of the book are your own personal stories. And you write about how your tenure at NPR has been immensely rewarding in no small part because of your colleagues Nina Totenberg and Linda Wertheimer. And I think one of your male colleagues called you all the fallopian jungle.
True story. He's not here anymore.
And you are.
That's right. We survive. It has been a remarkable relationship. You know, I think female friendships are always important, and we rely on our friends just incredibly, and men do too, but not to the same degree that women do. And in fact, there's some new scientific studies out showing that friendship actually causes you to live longer and to be healthier. I can see why that would be true. So to have these very close friendships in the workplace has been extraordinary. And not only have we not had any competition with each other, but we have been a constant source of support and comfort for each other, not to mention humor.
Much of your book is about the different perspective that women bring to whatever their profession is. And, for example, you write about in journalism, with more women doing political reporting, a candidate's character has become more of a newsworthy issue.
I think that's one of the things, you know, a lot of people think, oh, why should we write about the personal life of a candidate? And the truth is we don't, unless it's a candidate running for a very high office, or unless there's some hypocrisy involved or something like that. But when someone is running for president of the United States, a singular office where, so far it's still he, is not in the Senate with the check of another 99 senators, or in the House with 434 other House members, that person's whole life is important in forming a judgment about whether he should serve. And I think that women, when they started covering politics and were on the bus with the candidates and the other reporters, started seeing how some of these candidates behaved and started writing about it because it mattered. And I think that was upsetting to a lot of the people who had traditionally covered campaigns. It was kind of what happens on the bus stays on the bus. And that wasn't necessarily true once women got on the bus.
Well, you've certainly been a role model for many, including me, and I want to take this opportunity to thank you for that.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. That means a lot to me. Thank you.
And I have been speaking with NPR senior news analyst Koki Roberts about her reissued book, We Are Our Mother's Daughters. Ms. Roberts, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Sally. It was lovely to be with you.